Father in heaven, thank you that we can again come together this Friday afternoon on your preparation day. And as we're thinking about preparing for the Sabbath, we're reminded of your great work in creating us. Please help us learn better how to cooperate with you in preserving and improving our bodies. We ask it all in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, we're on the fifth and final installment in our series dealing with optimizing brain health. This series dealing especially with brain health. After we covered hemorheology, we spoke about BDNF, brain-derived neurotrophic factor. We talked about four ways you could improve it. Let's have a little review. What four things can you do to improve levels of this brain healing and brain healthy compound? Okay, giving blood helps the blood fluidity. So you're exactly right. That's one of the things that we talked about. But now we're moving to the material speaking about the BDNF. Giving blood, to my knowledge, does not necessarily improve that, but I've not seen a study on it. So you just may be ahead of me on that one. Okay? Exercise. That's exactly right. Exercise boosts BDNF levels. What else? That's right. Caloric restriction. I heard someone say that. So eating less boost levels of BDNF. What else? Environmental enrichment. So being in a stimulating environment. So some of you say, what really drives me nuts is these people in church who make all this noise. Well, actually, that's an environmentally enriched environment. Now, by the way, I'm not speaking against reverence in church. Don't misunderstand me. But what I'm saying is what environmental enrichment is, it's actually challenging the brain on a moderate level, and it's things that put you out of your comfort zone. When you go on a mission trip, you're getting environmental enrichment. When you come to camp meetings, you're getting environmental enrichment. When you sit down at the lunch table with someone from maybe a different culture or someone that you normally wouldn't sit with, that's environmentally enriching. When you come to classes, you get the point? Okay, we talked about those three things. There's a fourth thing that also will help you boost BDNF levels. That's right, alcohol avoidance. So stay away from even moderate drinking. Those things will help you boost BDNF levels. Then we started to talk about other more generalized things that can help the brain. And we started by talking about fats. This is where we're going to pick up the story and we'll add to it. Remember we found that good fats can actually help prevent one of the leading causes of death in America, which is stroke. Not only one of the leading causes of death, but one of the leading causes of morbidity. That means pain and suffering and disability. We found that the omega-3 fats, the research indicates whether they come from fish or from plant sources, omega-3 fats have brain-enhancing benefits and can help you prevent stroke. As an aside, the omega-3 fats also have mood-elevating effects. So if you tend to be depressed, you want to eat more omega-3 fats. We found that these fats also improve blood fluidity. Furthermore, this is really key, they make the nerve cell membranes more flexible. Perhaps here's the easiest way to understand it. If you look at a saturated fat at room temperature, what is the phase that it's in? Solid, liquid, or gas? It's solid, that's right. Saturated fats tend to be solid at room temperature. What about your polyunsaturated fat? They tend to be liquid at room temperature. So the fats that you find, omega-3 fats, are very polyunsaturated. They may have 5 or 6 polyunsaturated bonds, if you will, okay, or double bonds. If you don't know the chemistry, that's okay. The point I'm simply making is that these are highly unsaturated fats. They tend to be liquid at room temperature. If you understand that dynamic, what is your body at right now? What temperature? Do any of you know? 98.6. Would you like to have fat that's solid in your body or more liquid or more flexible? This is just kind of I'm doing this by way of a didactic technique, you know, a teaching technique. The idea is if your membranes are made up of mostly polyunsaturated fats, the membranes are more fluid. If you have diabetes, insulin will work better if you don't eat animal products with a saturated fat because the membranes are more fluid and the insulin can interact with the cell membrane and tell the cell to accept sugar. It's the same with the brain transmitters. If the membranes are more fluid, the neurotransmitters like dopamine and serotonin can interact with your brain better. So the things you want to make your friends are the plant fats. I don't recommend the fish fats. We talked about this a little bit earlier because of the contamination, the heavy metals. We'll speak more about that in a little bit. So just as omega-3 fats help the brain, so do the saturated fats found in animal products, and the trans fats harm cell transmission. Where do you get trans fats from? Yeah, partially hydrogenated vegetable oils, okay? And by the way, the movement is to phase these totally out of the diet. I can remember in the 70s, when people were finally getting concerned about cholesterol, they started making all these corn oil margarines. Do you remember that? And they would partially hydrogenate them to make them more like butter. And so this was kind of the cutting edge science. They're going to help you lower your cholesterol with this corn oil instead of eating butter. But actually, when they doctored up these natural compounds, they made them actually probably more harmful as far as their fat constituents. Be very careful of anything that they promise you is a high-tech solution so that you can enjoy all your favorite foods, you can eat all the artificial sweeteners and artificial fats. What science tends to confirm over time is that no one has been able to improve on the Creator. You know, enjoy the fruits, the vegetables, the whole foods. That's us. Let's talk a little bit more about stroke, because it is one of the leading cognitive robbers. I was just speaking with someone recently, a friend of mine, a bit older than I am, and he had a stroke. Why did he have a stroke? Well, I won't disclose anything about his situation, even though I haven't named him, but the odds are, if you know someone who had a stroke, that they had one of these modifiable risk factors. Now, not necessarily. If a person has high blood pressure, it will dramatically increase their risk of stroke, approaching a doubling of risk. Being married actually lowers your risk of stroke. I hear some of you laughing. The men don't. Well, maybe I. How many? What's the gender makeup of this room here? I don't want to get into too much trouble. But there is a gender difference in the benefits of marriage in most of the research. There is actually one gender that seems to benefit more from marriage than the other. And so as not to offend the men, I won't say which gender has benefited more. But I'll tell you it's not the women. Okay? So I know we may have some delusions that we did our wives a favor, those of us who are married, but really our wives have done us much more of a favor as far as the science. And you'll have to listen to the recording if you missed that the first time. Okay. By the way, in the Alameda County study, we talked about this a little bit since we're on this subject, and I mentioned this earlier. They looked at these, I speak about this in some detail on that DVD, Changing Bad Habits for Good, but let me give you the sound bite that I want you to take away. Very famous study came out of the 60s, one of the first studies to show that lifestyle made a difference on how long we live. So they found things like exercise and not smoking and eating breakfast, all these things help people live longer. You say, okay, I'm falling asleep, Dr. DeRose. Well, I understand that. We've all heard this for years. But here's the interesting thing that many people don't know. As powerful as those things were, by the way, those factors could cut risk of death by a half to a quarter. In other words, you know, four times the risk of death in people who weren't doing these simple lifestyle things. But even more powerful than those lifestyle habits that are usually discussed are the social factors that include marriage. And again, in that study, it was much more beneficial for men. But women got a benefit too. I just want you to know. And being involved with a church or a faith community actually was associated with longevity. So you can honestly tell your friend that when you invite them to church, you're trying to help them live longer. I mean, this is true. And Other things that they looked at was contact with friends and relatives. And this had a gender bias as well. Who do you think got more longevity benefit from contact with friends and relatives? Was it men or women? It was actually women. So this is supposed to help men be more compassionate when their wives or significant others are wanting to spend time on the phone or Skyping family members. This is an investment in their longevity. Well, let's go on. HDL cholesterol. HDL is the so-called good cholesterol. The higher it is, the better. We'll talk some about that. And depression. Actually, if you're depressed, you're at higher risk of a stroke. If you didn't notice, 3 out of 4 of these factors are related to dietary fat. We've been speaking some about mental health and depression and nerve transmission, but let's look a little bit at blood pressure as well. Some of you know we have this whole series. It's not, unfortunately, on sale at camp meeting, but you can get it through Amazing Facts, a 3-hour series on reversing high blood pressure naturally. In it, we talk about this kind of material, how the omega-3 fats actually do what? They help to reduce blood pressure in individuals with high blood pressure, but not those with normal pressure. Now, why is that good news? Well, if you have lower or normal pressure, you don't have to say, oh, I better not eat too many walnuts or I'll go into shock. Now, if you have an anaphylactic reaction, that means a severe allergic reaction to walnuts, you could go into shock. But walnuts are actually a healthy food, rich in omega-3 fat. If you shift from saturated fat to monounsaturated fat. Now, saturated fat would be typical in animal products. Do you know any foods that are rich in monounsaturated fat? Olives. Olives are a classic one that are rich in monounsaturated fat. That will lower the diastolic. That's the lower number of blood pressure. So there's a number of studies that look at fat intake and blood pressure, and so I recommend it for that reason. What about HDL cholesterol? We're talking about optimizing our mental health, preventing strokes. You say, well, this isn't really my concern, Dr. Groves. Well, it should be, because this is the leading cause of morbidity, suffering, and mental limitation. Let me tell you a little bit about HDL. A lot of people have trouble understanding how can there be a good cholesterol and a bad cholesterol. So we have a picture of a bus here. Have any of you ever ridden in one of those double-decker buses? Okay, see a number of you have. The bus in this illustration is going to represent LDL cholesterol. You say, Dr. Groves, you've got me totally confused. What are you talking about? Let me ask you a question to make this practical. How many of you rode on a freeway to get here to camp meeting? By the way, do you call them freeways here? Okay. Interstate? Okay. So a number of you rode on the interstate. How many of you were riding on the interstate? As you were riding, you saw people walking with the flow of traffic on those dotted white lines and cars and vehicles were whizzing by them. How many of you saw that? None of you saw that. Well, then how do people travel on the freeways in our nation or in Minnesota in particular? How do they travel? They're in vehicles. They're always in vehicles. If you understand how people travel on roads, you understand how cholesterol travels in your body. It does not float around in your blood. It's always in what? A vehicle. Yes, some of you are catching on to the analogy. The vehicle that cholesterol travels in that is harmful is the bus. The bus is taking cholesterol. We call it LDL. The LDL bus is taking cholesterol and it's carrying it to your arteries where it adds to the blockages. Are you following along? Well, in this analogy, then, what would the HDL, the so-called good cholesterol, be? It's the cholesterol in a garbage truck. If you're riding in a garbage truck, where would you like to ride? In the driver's seat, okay, or in the cab. But the cholesterol in the HDL garbage truck is riding in the back with the trash. What I'm trying to help you see is there's no difference in the cholesterol. We call HDL good cholesterol because that cholesterol is being removed from the blockages and brought to the liver where your body eliminates it. We call cholesterol in the LDL carrier bad because it's being carried to the arteries. Do you see how that works? So the cholesterol is the same, it's just where it's going. So sometimes that helps to remove a little confusion for people. Others of you just got more confused, so you just erased the last 2 minutes that I gave you, okay? How do you raise HDL? The bottom line, remember, HDL is good, it's cleaning out your arteries. How do you get it higher? One thing you can do, like this gentleman, is regular exercise. Regular exercise. This guy is amazing. I mean, really, he is. I've shown his picture a number of times, and he's always running. So, regular exercise. If overweight, weight loss boosts HDL. But something interesting I should let you know. If you lose weight rapidly, the HDL usually goes down first before it comes up. So just keep that in mind. And you're better off not to lose the weight too rapidly anyway. Now, saturated fat, do we find that was good or bad? It is bad, but it does raise HDL. Unfortunately, it actually raises LDL more, and it raises cholesterol in the arteries, it increases blockages. So you don't want to eat more saturated fat to raise HDL that way. Polyunsaturated fats, like you find in the omega-3 fats and other plant sources, as well as the monounsaturated fats, like you find in olives, and peanuts, and other sources, they have modest HDL raising effects as well. But the worst fats of all are the trans fats, those partially hydrogenated vegetable oils. If you see that on an ingredient list, what should you do? You shouldn't eat it. You don't really want that stuff. One of you helped me recently. You saw me innocently thinking that something had no trans fats in it, and you warned me, and I was scared. That's probably why I'm still talking with you. No, that would be a gross exaggeration. Depression score. Remember, we spoke some about depression. If you have mental health issues, I recommended to you Dr. Nedley's depression recovery program. Saturated fat and trans fats raise cholesterol levels. High cholesterol, in turn, actually increases your risk of depression. Isn't that amazing? So you thought it was just a heart risk factor, but depression rates are higher if you have high cholesterol. So I recommend you be serious about your cholesterol. Many people can control their cholesterol with lifestyle alone. If you have some specific questions, we might address those in our question and answer time. So bottom line, just make this connection. Cholesterol also can interfere with membrane health. Higher cholesterol levels may make it harder for serotonin, this mood-elevating compound, to work. High cholesterol, high saturated fat, both those things come from animal products. They worsen brain health. Let's move on to tyrosine and tryptophan. These are the raw materials that the brain makes critical neurotransmitters from. These compounds are what we call amino acids. They are the building blocks from which proteins are made. If you were to think of a protein as a train, the amino acids would be the cars that make up the train. So let's look at these, tryptophan and tyrosine. Serotonin, like I said, is made from tryptophan. It is a mood-elevating compound. Most of the commonly prescribed antidepressants work by increasing serotonin levels in the brain. Low levels of serotonin, similarly, can actually trigger depression in susceptible people. The interesting thing, though, is if your brain is wired very well and very resilient against depression, you may have low serotonin levels in the brain and not be depressed. So you can't just say, well, I don't have depression, so I don't need to worry about optimizing neurotransmission with serotonin. No, we should all be concerned about this. We're going to talk a little bit now about tryptophan and how it works. If we were to take the tryptophan out of someone's diet, they have a history of depression, they will often go into relapse. They will often go back into depression if we deplete the diet of tryptophan. Normal subjects, if you don't get enough tryptophan to your brain, you won't go into depression. But here's the point, it will affect your mood. It will affect your outlook. And maybe that's why you had that argument in the church board the other week. Do you remember that? Maybe someone wasn't getting enough tryptophan to their brain. Serotonin is also very important in triggering satisfaction at mealtime. So if you have a problem with overeating and you have a hard time stopping when you know you should stop, if you can increase serotonin in your brain, you'll be more likely to stop when your hunger is satisfied, stop eating, and you'll be less likely to eat between meals. So what I'm trying to help you see is that serotonin is important for everyone, whether or not you ever have to deal with depression. Okay, let's talk a little bit about this just a bit more. Serotonin is not only involved in controlling our appetite for food, it's also involved in helping people who are trying to break free from addictive substances. If you can increase serotonin levels in people who have cravings for alcohol or narcotics like morphine, stimulants like amphetamine and cocaine, you can actually increase their likelihood of staying clean and sober. Here's how the body makes serotonin. I know this may not show up all that well, but you start with the amino acid L-tryptophan. It's converted into something called 5-hydroxy-L-tryptophan, and then it's made into serotonin. So you take in the raw material, and it's converted into serotonin. This process takes place in the brain. So the rate of production of serotonin at the brain level is dependent on how much of the raw material, tryptophan, you get into your brain. So how many of you want to try to get more tryptophan into your brain? We should all want that. So how do you do it? Well, what do? Let me tell you a sad story if you've never heard of it. You heard of the Iroquois theater? You have a question? I'm losing you already. Oh, ADHD? Oh, and he's putting them on amphetamines. Okay. Well, I think you need a pediatric neurologist and not an internal medicine and preventive medicine specialist like me. But I will tell you this. There is evidence that the whole lifestyle approach helps ADHD as well. So the things we're talking about can help other brain disorders as well. But let me tell you this analogy here about the Iroquois theater. This was the greatest single building fire disaster as far as death toll in history in the United States. Over 600 people died in my hometown of Chicago. By the way, if you're wondering, this was before I was born, 1903. And just a terrible tragedy. Do you know why so many people died? Well, one of the reasons, it was a new theater. It had only been open something like 5 months. There's an actual photograph of the burned out theater. They had some unconventional doors. They opened in a funny way. And also they opened inward. So when people rushed to the doors, they not only trampled each other, but they couldn't open the doors. Here's the problem. You might have plenty of people trying to go through a door, but if there's a lot of competition, no one may get in. Okay? I tell you that because that's how the brain works as well. You see, tryptophan, in order to get into your brain, has to go through the same doors, if you will, that other amino acids use to go into your brain. So if you flood the system with a high tryptophan food, look at this! I just read this! Beef has all kinds of tryptophan. Milk has got lots of tryptophan in it. Problem is, these high-protein animal foods have lots of other amino acids as well. And they send this flood of amino acids to your brain, and the tryptophan cannot get in effectively. This is not just theory. Some of you who always look for a chance to review your biochemistry and nutrition, we have a list here of some of these large neutral amino acids. The rest of you could probably care less. These are just the names of some of the amino acids that compete with tryptophan to get into your brain. So here's what's so interesting. You think you're eating all this tryptophan by eating high-protein food, but high-protein intake actually drops brain levels of tryptophan. Here's what you want to look at. You want to look at the ratio of tryptophan to these competing amino acids. If you want to get the most tryptophan into your brain, you want tryptophan to be higher, relatively higher, than the other amino acids. Well, how do you do that? You actually eat more carbohydrates. If you eat more proteins, they flood the system with amino acids and the tryptophan can't get in optimally. If you eat a higher carbohydrate diet, so that means whole grains, that means beans, that means starches like potatoes and carrots, you're going to actually help more tryptophan get in your brain. This is not just theory, this is reality. Here's a study from the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition some years ago. We're not recommending that you just eat sugar or just pure starch, but these actually boost tryptophan delivery to the brain, whereas a fat and protein diet drops it. Now, this should be very interesting to you for several reasons. Some of you, when you're feeling kind of down, you want to eat a bunch of sugar. Are you starting to understand why? It actually raises serotonin levels in your brain. So you might understand why you're tempted to eat sugar. Some people have been telling you, you need to be on the Atkins diet like me. Then you'd lose weight. A very interesting thing about the Atkins diet, no one can stick with it forever. Because what happens when you're just eating fat and protein, your serotonin levels drop in your brain. If you're prone to depression, you're going to get off that diet in a very short time. If you're pretty resilient, you may stick with it for longer. But no one sticks with an Atkins diet for their whole life. I've never met anyone. Maybe there's a few exceptions out there somewhere. But some of the researchers that clarified this and explained why people can't stick with these diets, by the way, they're hard on the kidneys, they're hard on insulin resistance, they make your membrane stiffer, even though you may lose some weight, it may seem like your blood sugar's improving, they're actually not ideal for diabetes. Researchers that really highlighted this were the Wortmans at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. This is actually some of the research they did. They showed what happened after you ate a typical meal. So in this slide here, we're looking at pure sugar and starch. Nobody's going to eat this. In this research, they looked at a real breakfast. They gave you a carbohydrate-rich breakfast to these subjects. They gave a protein-rich subject in another phase. And you can see here what happened. If you're eating a carbohydrate-rich meal, within a short time, that tryptophan to competing amino acid ratio increases. That means more tryptophan will be delivered to the brain. Whereas when you eat that protein-rich diet, your levels drop and further and further and further, and you will actually be worse off as far as getting tryptophan into your brain. So the solution is not eating more protein, it's eating good complex carbohydrates like we find in a vegetarian diet. By the way, animal products have very little in the way of carbohydrates. Meat, virtually zero carbohydrates. Now, this is interesting. If you're prone to stress and you're having difficulty dealing with stress, you will also benefit from eating more carbohydrates and eating less protein. It actually prevents a deterioration in mood and it helps your performance to stay up at its highest level in stressful situations. So if you tend to have trouble with stress, you want to eat more fruits. You want to eat more whole grains. You want to eat more brown rice and whole wheat. You say, Dr. DeRosa, I'm gluten intolerant. Well, then stay away from the barley, the rye, and the wheat, and eat the whole corn and the whole rice, and you get the message, right? What about tyrosine? Now, tyrosine is another amino acid, so it's another protein building block that the brain uses to make neurotransmitter. Tyrosine is used to make dopamine as well as norepinephrine and epinephrine. Dopamine is especially important in a number of respects. It's involved in reward pathways in the brain. It's also very important for a common problem in America. Do you know a common problem that interferes with sleep that's related to low dopamine levels? It's the restless leg syndrome. So if you have a problem with restless legs, you want to try to maximize tyrosine delivery to your brain so that you can make more what? Dopamine. Are you kind of following along? Well, how many of you have ever been to an auto plant? You ever been to an auto plant? A few of you? And they bring steel into the auto plant, is that right? Okay, some of you are nodding your head. And they make cars out of this stuff. What happens if you change the raw materials coming into the auto plant from steel to aluminum? Do you think anyone would notice the difference? How about if your car was made out of, the body of your car was made out of aluminum? Would it be a different car? It's not better, get better gas mileage, Dr. Garone. Well, you may. It might be lighter, but what would happen if you had an accident? This would not be good, right? It's the same with the brain. Whatever you bring in as the raw material is what it can use to make the finished product. So you bring in tyrosine and you bring in tryptophan and it can make the finished product, which are these neurotransmitters. Well, how do you raise dopamine levels? Before we go there, let me just remind you there's some other conditions that dopamine is very important for. People with Parkinson's disease, that is a disease of dopamine deficiency in some critical brain regions like the basal ganglia. You give more tyrosine, get more tyrosine delivery to the brain, and that will improve Parkinson's symptoms. Tyrosine, if you can get more of it into the brain, look what it does. It improves cognition and performance under stress. So both tyrosine and tryptophan, the more you get those into the brain, the better your brain is going to function when you're challenged. So how do we do it? Do we have to have a different eating program to get more tyrosine into the brain? What do you think? It actually just so happens that the very same things that boost tryptophan boost tyrosine in the brain as well. I know some of you are interested in this about stress, so I don't think we need to belabor it. The point is, tyrosine and dopamine, these neurotransmitters, help you deal with stress better. Whether it's cold stress or multitasking stress, there's a number of types of stress that are studied in research settings. Let's look now at tyrosine. Same story. Tyrosine, like tryptophan, has to compete with other amino acids to get into your brain. And Wortman did their research on tyrosine as well. It looks like a mirror image with tryptophan. You see what happens? You eat the carbohydrate-rich diet, and what happens? These levels tend to rise. They drop off a little after about, what, 6 hours? 4 hours. 4 hours. And you can see here, when you eat the protein-rich meal, the levels just drop and drop. The practical application of this is illustrated sometimes when I call a hotel. I'm staying out of town somewhere, and I say, is there breakfast available at the hotel? Oh, yes! We have a wonderful breakfast bar at our hotel. And it's just, people just rave about it. It's tremendous! So I go down to the breakfast bar. And the people, yeah, they've got the donuts there and the coffee. They've got ham. They've got eggs. They've got bacon. I mean, it is just a feast for anyone who wants to depress their tryptophan and tyrosine levels in their brain. Yeah. And they're probably feeling so bad after the breakfast the day before that they were so excited to get down there. But I wasn't, because my brain was working fine and I knew what would happen if I ate that stuff. So, unfortunately, people really don't understand what a good breakfast is in America yet. So the ironic conclusion, if you want to boost these levels of protein building blocks in your brain, you understand this. Tyrosine and tryptophan are amino acids. They're protein building blocks. They're found in protein. The ironic conclusion is to build these protein constituents in the brain, to get more of them in, you actually have to eat what? Less protein. I mean, it's amazing. I won't go through all the physiology with you. It gets boring to most lay people. But it actually has to do with insulin and other things. And when you eat those carbohydrates, it stimulates insulin release. And insulin also helps to lower levels of proteins, amino acids in the blood, and does a number of interesting things. You actually boost levels of tyrosine and tryptophan with this approach. Well, let's talk about a couple of other things, then we'll take some time for questions and answers since it's our last session. We want to decrease our heavy metal exposure. This is really important. We've talked about this in a number of ways in some of these meetings if you've been with us from the beginning. Check your water. Make sure your water's not contaminated, especially if you drink from a well, because no one's necessarily monitoring that. Make sure you're not like one of my friends some years ago who was drinking huge amounts of arsenic in his water because he never had tested it. You say, well, Dr. DeRose, I know iron is good for me. That's one of those heavy metals that's good. Well, actually, the evidence is yes, you need some iron. You have to have iron to make hemoglobin. But once your iron levels start getting higher than just about the bare minimum, you start getting into trouble. Serum ferritin is a measure of total body iron stores. And in this data that came out in the 90s, they showed that as you rose as far as your body iron stores, your risk of having a heart attack, an acute myocardial infarction, increased. Well, this is quite interesting. One of the reasons that the vegetarian diet may be so advantageous is because it's relatively low in iron. You don't want a huge amount of iron. Now, you ladies that are dealing with anemia, yes, you need to get enough iron. But large amounts of iron are actually not desirable, and this is quite interesting. In the research, if you want to build iron levels, which we're finding is not good, you don't want real high iron levels, you eat more meat, and interestingly, drink more alcohol. These are things that raise iron levels in the body. They're actually harmful for the heart, but they're also harmful for optimal brain function. Look at this summary from one of the research studies. Heavy metals, through their tendency to stimulate both oxidative processes and protein aggregation in the brain. What they're saying is, these heavy metals, like iron, if you have higher iron levels, it stimulates a natural kind of degradation that we call oxidation. And it also causes the proteins to clump together. That's what's happening in Alzheimer's disease, for example. And so what this summary, this is a research review from a few years back, they're saying one of the big culprits as far as our eroding neurocognitive status in the Western world are these heavy metals. This is the review I was referring to. They speak about not only Alzheimer's disease, but Parkinson's disease. And so Parkinson's disease, they find excess iron accumulation in regions of the brain that go along with Parkinson's. So lower iron levels are actually desirable. Other metals may also be harmful, like copper. Do you have copper pipes in your house? This is one of the reasons they recommend that you don't drink the water out of your tap first thing in the morning, that you run the water through the pipes so you don't drink the water that's been sitting in those copper pipes for so long. You say, Dr. DeRose, we've advanced beyond that. All our pipes are PVC. Well, just keep this in mind. Be careful of what you're drinking, and then also realize that big connection with iron is with animal products. You say, but Dr. DeRose, like you, I didn't know anything about a vegetarian diet growing up. I ate meat for many years. Well, you want to make some friends with these polyphenols. These are phytochemicals that can help lower iron levels in the body. Quercetin is found in many plant products. Curcumin is found in turmeric, the yellow herb. These have natural chelating or iron binding properties. EGCG, epigallocatechin gallate, kind of a mouthful. I don't recommend you get in its natural state because it's found in green tea. You say, Dr. Morales, I knew it. I knew the tea was good for me. That's what I've been reading about. Well, the problem is it's also got caffeine in it. You get plenty of good chelators here. Remember, caffeine upsets the neurotransmitter balance, and we studied how it upsets adenosine and upsets blood flow to the brain. So this is not something that you really want. Do you want to take an EGCG supplement? That's another question. And I'll tell you, you probably don't want to do that. I quickly threw this slide together last night just to remind you that there are many, quote, natural supplements out there that are contaminated with heavy metals. We spoke in our series, Ancient Secrets, Modern Health, about Ayurvedic medicine. We said that they have some wisdom about herbal therapies, but many traditional Ayurvedic remedies have heavy metals in them. So just because something's natural doesn't mean it's healthy. And again, if you just request a handout from me, you'll get this, and you can magnify it and read it. I want to tell you a little bit about hormesis. And this is a very interesting concept, because we're speaking about taking supplements. Should you take a lot of supplements? Let me just read a definition here from the medical literature. Hormesis has long been used to describe the phenomenon where a specific chemical, or we could say agent or stimulus, is able to induce biologically opposite effects at different doses. Most commonly, there's a stimulatory or beneficial effect at low doses and an inhibitory or toxic effect at high doses. How about exercise? We talked about exercise, how it can boost BDNF levels. Do you remember how it works? It stimulates the brain. It challenges the brain. So if walking a half mile is good for you, if you walk tomorrow morning for 26 miles, that would be better. True or false? Now, some of you, that might just be way too much. In fact, you've missed church, and we've missed you there, and you've missed the social support, right? But how about fasting? Does fasting raise levels of BDNF? So if a little fasting is good, much is better, right? How many of you think maybe we should pass out a pledge card here, and we'll all pledge to a 40-day fast? By the way, do you remember I told you there's a section in Councils on Diet and Food, some very balanced insights on fasting, and Ellen White made it very clear there'd be no benefit in a 40-day fast. God does not require this of us. Jesus did that for us. Now, I wish this patient had been a Seventh-day Adventist, and I could have referred him to Councils on Diet and Food. But I'm thinking of a gentleman I had some years ago that I put on a medically supervised fast. And he got so much benefit from it after 5 days, he begged me to stay on the fast longer. Well, he was in one of our lifestyle programs. I was working in a lifestyle center at the time. We had a 3-week program. I said, well, you know, we want you to start getting on a normal diet and learn how to eat a better way when you go home, but can't I just fast a little bit longer? Okay, we checked his blood, and let him fast another few days. I see him back, and he says, Dr. DeRose, the Holy Spirit told me I have to fast for 40 days. Now, I want to let you know I'm not the Holy Spirit, and I won't presume to tell someone if they think the Holy Spirit is telling them to do something. I'm not going to tell them they can't, but I had serious doubts that that was really the Holy Spirit. But he ended up fasting for 26 days. He left that program, never ate. I was relieved to hear that he did go back to eating, you know, before the 40-day mark. But the point is, you don't need to do that. So, if you were to fast for the rest of your life, how much would it extend your lifespan? No, it's shortening. This is the concept of hormesis. A little is good, too much is better. Right? Wrong. Too much is harmful. Let's read on. In the case of natural compounds, an example of hormesis is vitamin A, which in relatively low amounts is essential for normal development and eye function, but in high amounts can cause anorexia, that's loss of appetite, headaches, drowsiness, altered mental state, and other symptoms. And we could add, it interferes with other compounds in this family of retinoids, the whole family, hundreds of compounds, and it will actually lower your immune system. This is one of the reasons I never recommend anyone taking a multivitamin that has vitamin A or beta-carotene. You don't want to do it. Because of this concept of hormesis. You start taking more of that, it upsets the balance of other things. So, the idea here we've been seeing, moderate stresses are good, moderate intakes of helpful compounds are good, but don't rush to the health food store and start taking large amounts of supplements, especially that you don't know really what they do just because you heard something good about it. Okay, fortify your brain to deal with traumatic stressors. We have some material in the DVD and in some of my other presentations about PTSD. I think in the interest of time, we won't share this. And I also realized that I put some special things in for you guys today that never showed up. Did you know with these fancy presentation programs today, you can have slides that no one ever sees because they're inadvertently hidden by the author? In this case, it would be me. Or he just started at the wrong place in his lecture, whatever the case was. Some of you were asking more about healthy fats. Let me just show you a few more slides. The very healthiest fats, if you look at the literature overall, are found in the nuts. And the nuts are actually very powerful. They have all kinds of good things. This is a review a few years ago, speaking about the phytochemicals in tree nuts. Some of you didn't realize all these polyphenolic compounds and all the good things that it does. I won't even try to pronounce the name, because if I could, you wouldn't probably be able to do it, but I don't think I can either. So that doesn't mean much. But we've known for years in the Adventist community what other people did not know. One of you was asking me, well, how come Dr. Esselstyn says you shouldn't eat any nuts? And how come Nathan Pritikin, you know, put people on a low-fat diet? And how come Dr. McDougall thinks fat is so bad? Let me explain something to you. Historically, people that started realizing the benefits of the vegetarian diet in the 60s and 70s thought the vegetarian diet was so powerful because it was low in fat. And so many of the early researchers who were using vegetarian diets, they were thinking it was due to the low fat content, and they made their prescription diets very, very low in fat. Along came the 1990s, and researchers at Loma Linda University, the Adventist Health Study. Seventh-day Adventists were known to have lower rates of death, lower heart from heart disease. And so the researchers, I remember talking with the lead investigator, one of the lead investigators, Dr. Sabate, and he was saying, they were thinking, what is the most protective foods in the Adventist diet? Maybe it's whole grain. Maybe it's legumes. So they analyzed the diet of Seventh-day Adventists, and what do you think they found was the most powerful thing in the diet to prevent heart disease? It's right here, it's nuts. So the people that were consuming nuts more frequently had roughly half the risk of fatal and non-fatal heart attacks as those who were seldom eating nuts. Isn't that interesting? That's what we call a dose-response effect. That means the more nuts they ate, the better the benefit. This has been shown now in other studies. This is from the Harvard group, Dr. Hu and others there at Harvard, and they've shown this in other populations as well. It's not just Seventh-day Adventists that get benefit from eating nuts. This, again, looking at those eating nuts frequently compared to those eating it seldom and lower risks of heart disease. Same is true with sudden death. Again, this is another data set, not the Adventist data set. So more nuts, less sudden death, about half the risk of sudden death. And diabetes, less diabetes in those who are consuming nuts more frequently. Presumably, because of their healthy fat content. Healthy fats slow digestion, so blood sugar doesn't rise as quickly. And remember, also, they have those favorable effects on the nerve transmitters, but also on the cell membrane where insulin works. So insulin presumably working better because of these healthy fats. Okay, well, we're going to end on that note, and I'll give you time for a few questions. The question right here up in front first. Maybe, Ed, you got a roving mic, but you speak up loud and we'll try to get right into it. Once a week? Eat that many nuts on the back of your hand? Oh. Yeah, that. Well, here's what they're getting at. You can't eat too many nuts. In fact, Ellen White spoke about the benefit that we have in adding nuts to our diet, how they can take the place of meat, but she did caution about eating too much. And this is good advice, because nuts are among the most calorically dense foods. So especially if you're trying to lose weight, you don't want to be eating pounds of nuts every day. And they are fairly difficult to digest. So I wouldn't make a rule as to how much, because it would be unfair. Some people have small hands and other people very big hands. I'm just kind of playing a little with you there. But the point is, there's not a simple rule of thumb for how much to eat. And here's why I'm telling it that way. Someone that has high caloric needs, someone who's younger, very active, they may be able to eat a lot more nuts than someone who's older and not doing as much. And that's not unhelpful that they're eating more than the other person. Do you see what I'm saying? So you can't make a precise rule of thumb, but your point is very good. We have to be careful not to eat too many. If you're doing fine with just a tablespoon of nuts, other people could have a bit more than that. It would be okay. A lot of the studies, when they're intervening with nuts, I think they use like 3 ounces, which would be more, I think, like the size of a deck of playing cards. Okay, the question has to do with peanuts. You know, even Ellen White was revealed that almonds were a better nut than peanuts. We know today that there's more saturated fat in peanuts than there are in things like almonds, pecans, or walnuts. So if you have concerns about your cholesterol, better nut choices would be those 3. Walnuts, pecans, almonds. Okay? If you have concerns with cholesterol, sometimes even the plant fat can be a problem. Be careful with peanuts. They're still pretty good. Worse than peanuts, though, are cashews, and even worse, are coconut. Some of you swear by coconut. It's going to save your life and help your brain and all. But many people cannot eat much coconut if they're susceptible to saturated fat for cholesterol elevation. We've actually seen it in clinical settings. People use more coconut, and if they're susceptible, their cholesterols go up. So coconut is not a panacea. It doesn't mean you can't use it. I put some on my breakfast cereal today, and I seem to be just fine. Okay. Question over here. Good breakfast, okay. Well, I try to eat a good breakfast, so you're getting me to try to reconstruct. The main thing that I eat for breakfast are whole grains. So today I had oatmeal, quite a bit of fruit, and some kind of nuts or seeds or nut butter. So they've been very nice here to us if you've been eating in the cafeteria, and they've had walnuts out every morning. So that's kind of the staples in my breakfast. Some people like to have more of a vegetable-based meal for breakfast. I never could quite get excited about that. My wife would be fine with it. So if you want to have us over and keep my wife happy and have me kind of looking around for, you know, some fruit and cereal, just serve us, you know, scrambled tofu and potatoes and, you know, kale for breakfast. Does that help you at all? Okay. Okay. We got a question over here. There's a few hands that they thought that the mic was coming over here, too. So go ahead.
Yeah, I had a question on water. I don't know, a while back when I was seeking for a better health because I thought I was eating a good Adventist diet, and I used to come home at 40, and I used to get so tired, and I knew something was wrong. But anyway, it was one of the things was about water. Is distilled water bad for you? Because some people say it leaches out the minerals out of your body. And is it better to drink water with a lot of iron in it? Because I don't think that the body can use things that haven't gone through the process of photosynthesis?
Okay, yeah, let me answer your question. The most important thing is to make sure your water has no toxins in it. And if you use charcoal filtration and combine it with distillation, that'll get most all the bad things out of it. It would be better to have water with nothing in it than to have water with bad things in it. Having said all that, if your water naturally contains some magnesium, that's actually a healthful mineral. Having some sulfur in the water, although it won't taste as good, is not particularly harmful. But many other substances are problematic. So, by the way, if there is sulfur in the water, if you just set it out, a lot of that will evaporate. Softened water is a problem. Softened water is typically softened by adding sodium to the water. And if you have a water softener, you need to do something to not drink that high sodium water. It can raise your blood pressure, contribute to fluid buildup, and other things. So you don't want to be drinking a lot of sodium in the water. Okay? Question?
I have a sister-in-law that has no teeth. How can they eat nuts of any kind?
Okay, well, there are nut butters. So you can use nut butters, and there are dentures as well that are an option. No, it won't work? Okay. Okay, no, I mean, there's no substitute for your own teeth. I'm not making light of it, but nut butters, some people prefer to eat the whole nuts, but the nutrient constituents are in the nut butters as well, or seed butters. Tahini is a good seed butter, a reasonable source of calcium as well. Go ahead, next question.
How do you raise your dopamine?
Okay, how do you raise dopamine? Dopamine is raised like raising serotonin. You improve the delivery of the raw material. Raw material for dopamine is tyrosine, and tyrosine is improved, the levels are improved in the brain by eating a carbohydrate-rich diet. So eating more liberally of the whole grains and the beans and those kind of foods, that helps to improve. If you eat a high-protein diet, that will tend to depress both tryptophan and tyrosine delivery to the brain. Will tend to lower dopamine and serotonin levels in the brain. We've worked with many diabetics. There are some people that avoid the carbohydrates with them. We have found that we can help people lose weight, can improve their blood sugar control, and they can eat plant sources of carbohydrates. But it has to be individualized. And, of course, you can eat too many. So in people with diabetes, they may benefit from eating some more protein and good fat. That may help their blood sugar to be stable and not eating quite as high a carbohydrate diet. So there is some truth in that. But people that go to the other extreme, it is the other extreme, and that's not optimal from the broadest research. Anderson, if you want to read research, Anderson out of Lexington, Kentucky, he's done a lot of work with carbohydrate-rich diets and diabetes.
Okay. Dr. DeRose, I've been wondering about some of the preliminary evidence that I've seen from the Adventist II health study and other studies suggesting that there is a lacto-ovo vegetarian advantage for longevity over a strictly vegan diet. Now, I ask because Ellen White, when you read Counsels on Diets and Foods, she seems to suggest a lacto-ovo diet as opposed to a strictly vegan diet for many people in her writings. And I also like to note that other studies have suggested that that there are some specific mortality risks with a pure vegan diet, and I want to get your thoughts on that, how you interpret the data when you see those studies and the like. And I'm especially concerned because I've been a vegan for 10 years now, and I want to get your thoughts on those so-called advantages or disadvantages.
Okay. Well, this will have to be our last question. We do have another seminar. Pastor Brower will be in here. And I was going to pull that slide up again, but I'm not seeing it. That I got another presentation that shows a very significant decrease in risk for both high blood pressure and diabetes in the vegans in the Adventist health study, significantly decreased risk of heart disease and heart disease death for the vegans. Here's what the problem is. Let me try to answer it very quickly. I've talked with the researchers there at Loma Linda. Dr. Fraser and I, who's the lead investigator there, we were at some meetings together in Europe last year, heard his presentations. We taught some in that venue. Here's what the problem is. The vegan population in the Adventist Church is what we call in research a dimorphic population. That means there's two groups of vegans in the church. One group of vegans are trying to be true to the science and medical recommendations and advice, and they're following a vegan diet for scientific as well as inspiration reasons. There's another group in the church that is, some people would describe them as more extreme. They're basically rejecting most of medical counsel, and they are And they think that all you have to do is follow the strictest diet of the Bible and spirit of prophecy, and that's all you need to do. What they're finding is that those people that reject screening tests, reject cancer screening, these people that often reject immunization, that often reject seeing doctors at all, end up with worse outcomes than the more middle-of-the-road people. So just throwing out everything and thinking that God is not using anyone unless they think just the way you are and are on the most strict program, and that's going to solve all your problems, that is not skillfully applying the medical knowledge that we have today. Since I mentioned immunizations, I'll just let you know there are huge outbreaks now in the world, including in the U.S., of vaccine-preventable diseases. People in the Adventist Church that are telling us that vaccines have caused the loss of more life and are terrible are just not being honest or don't know the public health data. Any of you that lived through the era of polio, you know some of what the vaccines have helped us with as a population. That's not, I mean, it's a long discussion, but I'm just saying it's not just the vegan diet. The vegan diet keeps company with some segments of the Adventist population that are rejecting good preventive medicine practices. Just for the record, you do know that Ellen White was vaccinated against smallpox and advised her co-workers to be vaccinated. That's in Second Selected Messages around, if I'm remembering correctly, around page 300. She speaks about some things. She even received radiation treatment. So using the best knowledge that we have is not wrong, but the foundation is lifestyle. But don't say, you know, every medical advance is of the devil, that I'm never going to see a doctor, I'm just going to be a vegan. Then you're asking for trouble, Nathan. Okay. Well, we do need to finish, and some of you have other places to go to. Some of you are staying by here for the next presentation. Let's pray together. If you have individual questions, I'll step out and back as soon as I gather things up. My cards are in the front there if you want more of those. Let's pray. Father in heaven, you've brought us together as one family, and we all see things differently. And we're promised, your Holy Spirit, to not instantaneously give us all truth, but to lead us into all truth. Help us realize that we're all on the same journey. Forgive me as we've been, you know, answering questions quickly here. If anyone's here feeling offended, we're all part of the same brotherhood and sisterhood. Please help us press together to use the health message to build up, not to tear down, to help our churches be agents of healing. Give us, each one of us, wisdom to know, first of all, what to do in our own lives and how to share that more effectively with people to make a difference for time, for eternity. We ask in Jesus' name.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. International copyright, all rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americanchristianministry.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He is coming soon.